fades, as silly as we find the leaders who excommunicated Galileo just because he insisted that the Earth was not the center of the universe, predicts Mullis. It has been disappointing that so many scientists have absolutely refused to examine the available evidence in a neutral, dispassionate way regarding whether HIV causes AIDS. All about the money. Today, the presumption that HIV is the sole cause of AIDS is the central presumption of a multi-billion-dollar industry. Everyone agrees that at least part of the explanation for its stupefying resilience is Dr. Fauci's relentless flow of cash. Charles Ortleb observed to me, "Science costs money, and he who dispenses the money can control the science." Look, there's no sociological mystery here, observed Mullis. It's just people's income and position being threatened by the things Peter Duisberg is saying. Their personal income and positions are being threatened, and that's why they're so nasty. In the 1980s, a lot of people started being dependent on Tony Fauci and his friends for their livelihood. All these people really wanted success in the sense of lots of people working for them and lots of power. Bialy agrees. First of all, there are tremendous financial and social interests involved. Billions of dollars in research funding, stock options, and activist budgets are predicated on the assumption that HIV causes AIDS. Entire industries of pharmaceutical drugs, diagnostic testing, and activist causes would have no reason to exist. The 2004 documentary, The Other Side of AIDS, includes a remarkable scene in which Canadian PI Mark Weinberg, MD, president of the International AIDS Society, the world's largest organization of AIDS researchers and clinicians, angrily calls for Duisberg and others who attempt to dispel the notion that HIV is the cause of AIDS to be brought up on trial. He considers HIV/AIDS skeptics perpetrators of death. I suggest to you that Peter Duisberg is the closest thing we have on this planet to a scientific psychopath. Then he declares the interview over, rips the microphone from his lapel, and storms off. What happened next was revealing. The audience erupted in laughter, which turned to boos as the screen flashed a list of Weinberg's patents and other financial ties to the HIV industry. Other causes. If HIV doesn't cause AIDS, one is bound to ask, then what does? Leading scientists have advanced multiple credible theories to account for AIDS pathogenesis. I will examine three of the most compelling, beginning with Duisberg's theory, since his explanation arrived first chronologically and inspired the largest and most influential following. Subsequent theories, including hypotheses promoted ironically by Robert Gallo and Luc Montagnier, have equal persuasive power but enjoyed meager public interest or support. Duisberg's battle royal had demonstrated Dr. Fauci's sizable power to destroy careers, and no one after Duisberg had the courage and appetite to challenge the little director by advancing new theories. Duisberg's theory. Duisberg, Mullis, and their school of critics blame all the lethal symptomology known as AIDS on a multiplicity of environmental exposures that became ubiquitous in the 1980s. The HIV virus, this group insists, was a kind of free rider that was also associated with overlapping lifestyle exposures. Duisberg and many who have followed him offered evidence that heavy recreational drug use in gay men and drug addicts was the real cause of immune deficiency among the first generation of AIDS sufferers. They argued that the initial signals of AIDS, Kaposi's sarcoma and pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, PCP, were both strongly linked to amyl nitrite, poppers, a popular drug among promiscuous gays. Other common wasting symptoms were all associated with heavy drug use and lifestyle stressors. Those interested in exploring the debate should read Chapter 3, Virus Hunting Takes Over, of Duisberg's riveting book, Inventing the AIDS Virus. Suffice it to say that Duisberg makes a compelling case, and his arguments deserve to be aired and civilly debated. Dr. Duisberg observed that critical AIDS cases in the 1980s were among men engaged in behaviors then commonplace in the post-Stonewall, drug-charged gay party scene. Risk factors included promiscuous sex with multiple partners and cumulative toxic exposures from psychoactive drugs including methadrine, cocaine, heroin, LSD, and a cocktail of antibiotics prescribed to treat ubiquitous sexually transmitted diseases. On average, the early AIDS patients had been on at least 3 antibiotics courses in the year preceding diagnosis. Some 35% of early AIDS cases were among IV drug users. In his paper, The Role of Drugs in the Origin of AIDS, Duisberg cites over a dozen medical references documenting AIDS-like immunodeficiency symptoms among drug addicts since 1900. The medical literature attests to the ravaging effects of heroin, morphine, speed, cocaine, and other injected drugs on the immune system. From as early as 1909, evidence has accumulated that addiction to psychoactive drugs leads to immune suppression, clinical autoimmunity, similar to AIDS. Today, thousands of American junkies who are not infected with HIV are losing the same CD4 plus T cells and getting the same diseases as AIDS patients. STDs from promiscuous sex and bloodborne diseases like hepatitis A, B, and C added to the immune suppression among this cohort. Duisberg's theory was by no means novel or outlandish. Dr. Fauci himself conceded in 1984 that drugs were a reasonable explanation for PCP and other signature symptoms of AIDS. "If I were to take drugs," he said, "that would markedly immunosuppress me, there would be a reasonably good chance that I would get that pneumonia. That's what happens to the AIDS individuals." Poppers and drugs. Prior to Gallo's discovery of HIV, the initial guess by government researchers and leading scientists was that recreational drugs were the prime suspects. Duke Medical School's renowned infectious disease expert, Professor David Durek, who served on NIH's bioethics committee, asked the still relevant question in his lead article in the December 1981 New England Journal of Medicine: how can AIDS be so evidently new when viruses and homosexuality are as old as history? Recreational drugs, according to Durek, should be considered as causes. "They are widely used," he said, "in the large cities where most of these cases have occurred. Perhaps, as suggested, one or more of these recreational drugs is an immunosuppressive agent." Durek observed that, other than drug-using homosexuals, the only patients with AIDS symptoms were junkies. In Duisberg's view, the highest risk addiction was the ubiquitous use of amyl nitrite poppers, which had well-established links with autoimmune disease. The first AIDS cases were 5 gay men, all unknown to one another, diagnosed with a rare PCP pneumonia and Kaposi sarcoma, a form of cancer that had previously afflicted only elderly men. In Los Angeles, in 1981, Dr. Michael Gottlieb, a researcher searching California hospitals for new diseases with unusual symptomology, is credited with the initial discovery and characterization of the disease and its epidemiologic context. The men were all promiscuous party enthusiasts in the fast lane gay lifestyle. They were taking many different recreational drugs simultaneously and combining drugs in excess of patterns among straight drug users. They frequented bars, clubs, and bathhouses. They had daily multiple anonymous sexual partners, upward of 1,000 per year, and contracted most of the common sexually transmitted diseases like syphilis, gonorrhea, and hepatitis B. They were, therefore, also functionally addicted to a pharmacopoeia of antibiotic prescription medications. All of that created a situation where a handful of gay men, says Mark Gabrish Conlon, were burning the candle at both ends and putting a blowtorch to the middle. It's no wonder that after a while their immune systems started to collapse and they started getting sick in these unusual ways that previously had only been seen in older people whose immune systems had deteriorated from age. John Lauritsen, a gay activist, was probably the longest-running AIDS journalist. My first major AIDS article was in 1985, he said. The very early AIDS cases were really quite sick, and there were very good reasons why they were sick. Lauritsen and many leading medical researchers and government health officials concluded early in the epidemic that paupers were the lead culprit. Chemists developed amyl nitrite as a vasodilator in the 1850s and began in the 1960s packaging it in glass ampoules that doctors would pop open under the noses of unconscious patients to reanimate them. That same mechanism that prompted reanimation provided the relaxation of the anal musculature and a powerful rush that made paupers the reigning sex drug. Paupers became a mainstay of the gay social scene in the late 1970s. Prior to 1987, every AIDS patient acknowledged heavy consumption of paupers. Every porn shop, bar, and bathhouse locker room sold paupers. Party gays huffed them continuously in dance clubs and during extreme sex. The saloons and dance halls reeked of their pungent chemical aroma. At the end of each evening, bartenders routinely announced, "Last call for alcohol, last call for paupers." Researchers believe paupers to be the direct cause of Kaposi's sarcoma, a rare form of skin cancer that afflicts the nose, throat, lungs, and skin. Kaposi's sarcoma was the initial indicator disease of AIDS, but it was also common in gay men who were not infected with HIV. Paupers can severely damage the immune system, genes, lungs, liver, heart, or the brain. They can produce neural damage similar to that of multiple sclerosis, can have carcinogenic effects, and can lead to sudden sniffing death. I discovered there was a very extensive medical literature on the volatile nitrites, Lauritsen explains. The simplest thing is that they are very powerful oxidizing agents, which is part of AIDS causes, in fact, several types of anemia. Secondly, paupers are powerfully mutagenic and carcinogenic, meaning that they cause cellular changes and cancer. One of my informants, Filson, who was very active and outgoing in the People with AIDS Coalition, claimed that he had interviewed several hundred gay men with AIDS, and he said that virtually all of them had been heavy users of drugs. They said without a single exception, they had all been paupers users. A study published by Toby Eisenstein showed that nitrites found in paupers are radically immunosuppressive in rodents. Government researchers and regulatory officials supported the association. Prior to Gallo's announcement, CDC had targeted paupers as the likely culprit for AIDS. A year before Gallo's announcement, CDC's in-house AIDS expert Harry Haverkos analyzed three surveys of AIDS patients conducted by the CDC. He concluded that drugs like paupers played a key role in the disease onset. L.T. Sigel wrote in the American Journal of Psychiatry that the inhaled nitrites produced nitrosamine, known for its carcinogenic effects. Thomas Haley of the Food and Drug Administration issued the same warning. Following Gallo's 1984 press conference, Dr. Fauci launched a mission to quash all conversation about cofactors like paupers. The CDC quickly fell in line. The CDC shelved the Haverkos study and began parroting Dr. Fauci's hostility toward the drug connection. The CDC actively suppressed disagreeable data and published one of its signature junk science papers to prove poppers safe. The CDC researchers assumed that gays used poppers as single-use reanimators and exposed laboratory mice to lifetime doses, a thousandth of what a gay man would get in one evening on the party circuit. The study was utterly fraudulent, remarks Lauritsen. Haverkos transferred to the FDA in 1984 to become AIDS coordinator there. His paper finally appeared in the journal Sexually Transmitted Diseases in 1985, prompting the Wall Street Journal to pen an article arguing that substance abuse was so universal among AIDS patients that drug use and not Dr. Fauci's virus must be considered the primary cause of AIDS. According to Randy Schiltz, writing in his classic History of the AIDS Crisis and the Band Played On, the popper's starting point offers a compelling explanation for AIDS. Everybody who got diseases seemed to snort poppers, writes Schiltz. As I wrote this book, children's health defense researcher Robin Ross, Esquire, alerted me to one of the unheralded ironies of this saga. As it turns out, Burroughs Wellcome holds the 1942 patent on the popper container and remained one of the largest manufacturers of poppers during the 1980s and 90s. As early as 1977, a New York Daily News article described Burroughs Wellcome's strategies for dodging criticism of widespread health injuries from its booming popper sales. As we shall presently see, Burroughs Wellcome and other popper manufacturers were the principal sources of advertising revenues to the gay press during that epoch, and they used that leverage to force censorship of any journalist attempting to link amyl nitrite to immune system collapse. If Duisberg and others are correct about that association, it means that Burroughs Wellcome was profiting from both causing the AIDS epidemic and then from poisoning a generation of gay men with the AZT cure. Tony Fauci played traffic cop in this feedback loop. On the one hand, he was using his regulatory authority to promote AZT and to kill its competition, effectively orchestrating Burroughs Wellcome's monopoly control over AIDS treatment. At the same time, he was suppressing the study of the toxicity of poppers and directing the blame for AIDS on the virus, thereby shielding Burroughs Wellcome from significant liability. Kaposi's sarcoma. In 1990, four leading scientists at the CDC suggested in The Lancet that Kaposi's sarcoma was common in young gay men who indisputably did not have HIV. They concluded that KS, the disease most central to the definition of AIDS, may be caused by an as-yet unidentified infectious agent transmitted mainly by sexual contact. This was a stunning development, because KS was the initial and defining symptom of AIDS. Prior to 1981, KS was a disease limited to very old people. Its sudden appearance in young men was the identifying signal that launched the AIDS crisis. It was fundamental doctrine within the medical establishment that KS was the diagnostic signal of the AIDS pandemic. The very existence of AIDS was inextricably linked to KS. If HIV was not responsible for the outbreak of Kaposi's sarcoma, then there had to be another culprit. That insurmountable logic raised the question of whether poppers might also be causing the other symptoms of AIDS, particularly the other major manifestation, immunosuppression, which science also linked to amyl nitrite. While publicly cleaving to Dr. Fauci's official HIV/AIDS orthodoxy, Robert Gallo himself privately signaled doubts about his own theory that HIV alone can cause either Kaposi's sarcoma or AIDS. At a high-level meeting of U.S. health authorities in 1994, titled "Do Nitrites Act as a Cofactor in Kaposi's Sarcoma?", Gallo made some astonishing confessions to his trusted colleagues. HIV, he acknowledged, might only be a catalytic factor in Kaposi's. There must be something else involved. Then he added a breathtaking concession, which could have been taken from the very research in Duisberg's article. "I don't know if I made this point clear, but I think that everybody here knows we never found HIV DNA in tumor cells of KS, so this is not directly transforming. And in fact, we've never found HIV DNA in T cells, although we've only looked at a few. So in other words, we've never seen the role of HIV as a transforming virus in any way." One attendee of that meeting was Harry Haverkos, by then director of the AIDS Department at National Institute on Drug Abuse, NIDA. Haverkos observed to Gallo that not a single case of Kaposi's sarcoma had been reported among blood recipients where the donor had Kaposi's sarcoma. "If blood transfusions couldn't spread the disease," Haverkos said, "then semen exchanges could hardly be a plausible culprit." In response, Gallo allowed, "The nitrites, poppers, could be the primary factor." To fully appreciate the seismic implications of Gallo's statement, we must recall that in wealthy nations like the United States and Germany, Kaposi's sarcoma was, along with PCP, the signature disease for diagnosing patients with AIDS. In 1987, for example, Der Spiegel described AIDS patients as the sarcoma-covered skeletons from the same-sex scene. By 1990, government regulators were already scrambling to drop Kaposi's sarcoma from the AIDS definitions. At present, it is accepted, even by CDC scientists, that HIV plays no role, either directly or indirectly, in the causation of Kaposi's sarcoma, wrote Australian biologist and AIDS expert Eleni Papadopoulos in 2004. This was a momentous bait and switch. Kaposi's was the AIDS-defining illness. In the beginning, says Farber, AIDS was Kaposi's sarcoma. Because its association with AIDS was so well established, the official concession that the two conditions are distinct has never penetrated the reigning orthodoxy. Kaposi's sarcoma remains part of the official AIDS definition in industrialized countries. Anyone with KS and a positive test result counts as an AIDS patient. And contrary to the facts, mainstream media outlets like The New Yorker still report that Kaposi's sarcoma is a sign of AIDS, i.e., HIV causes KS. AZT as culprit. After 1987, Dr. Duisberg and his followers argue, the vast majority of AIDS deaths were actually caused by AZT, Dr. Fauci's radical antiretroviral chemotherapy, purposefully concocted to kill human cells. Duisberg describes the syndrome as AIDS by AZT. Ironically, he argued AZT, the highly toxic medication that Dr. Fauci was prescribing to treat AIDS patients, actually does what the virus cannot, that is, it causes AIDS itself. In a rational universe populated by critical thinkers, Duisberg's suspicion that AZT causes immune collapse should never have seemed revelatory. The FDA, after all, had deemed AZT too toxic to use for even short-term cancer therapy. AZT is highly mutagenic, meaning that it destroys the genes themselves. It causes cancer in rodents. It targets the bone marrow where blood cells called lymphocytes are made. These are the very cells that an AIDS patient needs most for immunity. AZT randomly destroys bones, kidneys, livers, muscle tissue, the brain, and the central nervous system. Cancer patients typically take chemo drugs for only 2 weeks. Thanks to Tony Fauci's official study, doctors were now prescribing AZT for life.